agriculture. She was the roughest, toughest, frail. Minnie had a heart.
We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Zoltan Grossman. Zoltan Grossman is a political culture geographer who teaches at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and he co-edited the book Asserting Native Resilience, Pacific Rim Indigenous Nations Face the Climate Crisis, and wrote an article for Counterpunch called Ukraine, The Enemy of Your Enemy is Not Always Your Friend. And joins us now to talk about that article and more about the Ukraine. And Zoltan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
I think the important piece for me in your article was that people watching the nightly news or reading their daily newspaper here in America don't get the sense of the dangerous nuance of what this conflict is about in terms of who the players are. That we don't know that, and we don't pay attention to it. We just cheer on anything we think looks like a democratic revolution.
Yeah, and I think that in the history of this region in particular, it's pretty easy for today's oppressed to become tomorrow's oppressors, and to simply see a Facebook meme or a YouTube video of a crowd standing up to riot cops, and the riot cops really are brutal and nasty and murderous, and so our hearts tend to go out to the people who are protesting. And that's a natural thing, but I think when we look at the composition of the folks who were protesting in Independence Square and Maidan in Kiev, it's a mixed bag. It was a very unpopular president, although he was elected fairly, Yanukovych. Like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, he did a lot of things that he didn't promise in the original election. So a wide breadth of Ukrainian society turned against him. So you had everywhere from leftists, ecologists, nationalists, and a very important far-right element, which has been growing in the last few years, a party called Svoboda, along with that's a fascist party, along with a Nazi organization called Right Sector. And as the confrontation grew in Kiev, those organizations tended to take the front of the confrontation. So a group called Anti-Fascist Action Ukraine, which has been monitoring the far-right in Ukraine, estimates that about 30% of the protesters before the violence really got bad were from fascist or Nazi parties. So it's wrong that all protesters were fascists, as Russian propaganda would state, but it's equally wrong and irresponsible to dismiss the idea that there are fascists in the new Ukrainian government as merely Russian propaganda, as merely a claim of Putin, which is how it's being portrayed in the Western media. A very important line has been crossed in Ukraine. Because in a lot of European countries, there are fascist far-right parties, usually anti-immigrant parties, in the parliament. But it's a very important line that's been crossed that they're now in the government, in the cabinet, in the executive branch, exercising real power. And that's what's of real concern. That's alienated a lot of Russians and other minority groups in Ukraine and contributed to the crisis. Because those far-right Ukrainian nationalists feed and reinforce Russian nationalism. The two extremes need each other and feed off of each other, and I think we're seeing that with the crisis in Crimea very shortly after these far-right parties took power in Kiev.
In the article, you mentioned these Svoboda party members, and you mentioned two of them, Oleksandr Sich, who is now the vice premier for economic affairs, and that they took over education, agriculture, and the environment, and that the co-founder of the party, Andrei Prubli, I don't know quite right pronunciation.
Yeah, that's close enough.
He's now Security.
National Security and Defense Council,
so these
which
are these,
has right, very real power over police and military. Mm-hmm.
And the people who have this power now are people who are on the far right. That's who these people are.
Yeah, and they're not a majority of this new government. They have representation far out of their proportion in the last election, which was about 10-11%. Not only is Parubi on the National Security and Defense Council, but his deputy, his guy named Dmytro Yarosh, who is from Right Sector, Pravi Sector, which is the outwardly Nazi organization. If you just put in a Google search on that organization, you can see some of their videos, which are very chilling, very militaristic, and really draw on National Socialist themes. And they use imagery from World War II and from the global white supremacist movement. The Wolfsangel, which is the symbol of the SS, is the party symbol of Svoboda. The Odin's Cross, or the circle with the cross through it, a recognized symbol of white power. You can see it on stormfront.org. That's the Pravi Sektor symbol, and they had that, along with the Confederate flag, actually, up in Kiev City Hall when they seized it during the overthrow of Yanukovych. They also have both Svoboda and Pravi Sektor fighters have been, and even deputies have been putting forth the slogan 1488. I've seen that several times now in photographs. 88 is, if you know anything about the white supremacist movement or white power metal music, that stands for HH, or Heil Hitler. The 14 words are from an American white supremacist, David Lane, with the Order, a terrorist group. He spent time in prison, and his 14 words were, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children." And you could see 1488 on some of the shields and Maidan in the square. Svoboda deputies were seen with two keys, kind of joking around that it's 1488. So here's Hillary Clinton saying that Putin is acting like Hitler by annexing neighboring territory. And she is fully aware that some of these people who are now in the new Ukrainian government are those who feel that the wrong side won World War II. They're not a majority in the government, but they have gone farther in the Ukrainian government than they have in almost any other government since World War II. There was a brief period of the far right being in the Austrian government in 2000, and there were sanctions issued by the EU against Vienna. There was a brief period when fascists were in the Italian government of Berlusconi in the 90s. But this is was much farther than any of the far-right groups have gotten in Europe, and it's an example to some of the other far-right groups in places like Hungary for them to be an example.
Again, this is, you know, when we're looking at this conflict, I think one of the things you wrote in your article was about the vote that Svoboda got, the right-wingers got, and it was like 10%, but higher in some of the Ukrainian areas, and that if you split apart what's happening in Ukraine now, to the historic Ukraine, the numbers, I mean, they're not the majority, but the numbers are higher.
Yeah, and definitely Western Ukraine, the area around the city of Lviv in particular, is the stronghold of the far right. You can't even lay flowers on the graves of Soviet soldiers who died in World War II because there are massive protests by some of these groups. And this was the area, it's actually an area of Ukraine that wasn't part of the Russian Empire or even the Soviet Union for a long time. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire or interwar Poland. And it was an area that welcomed the Nazi invasion in 1941, thinking that Stepan Bandera, who was the leader of the Ukrainian insurgent army, recognized the Germans as allies and thought that they would set up an independent Ukrainian puppet state with him at the head. It turns out that the Germans actually wanted Ukrainian land for German settlers and saw Slavs as subhumans, so kind of turned their back on potential Ukrainian allies. So the Ukrainian insurgent army ended up fighting the Germans, but somehow you're not really a resistance movement if you wanted to be a Nazi and the other Nazis wouldn't let you play. And in the meantime, the Ukrainian insurgent army slaughtered Poles in this area of Western Ukraine, Nazi-occupied Poland, and also killed between 50 and 100,000 Catholic Poles who were in the way of this vision of a pure Ukrainian state. And it's this Ukrainian insurgent army, which last January, Svoboda, this fascist party that's now in the government, held a huge torchlight parade to commemorate the birthday of Stepan Bandera. And so it's a very chilling rewriting of the history of the war to portray the fascist side as somehow the heroes. And that is kind of a harbinger for how they want the new Ukraine to go.
So during these protests, you write, that were taking place, and just kind of sort this out, I mean, there's a lot of conflict that sounds internally inside of Ukraine and among Ukrainians themselves over what to do next. When you write about the protests in Kiev's Independence Square and the Maidan protesters, there were integrationists in terms of, I mean, people wanted to go be part of integrating with the European Union, lefters who didn't like Russia or the EU, LGBT activists, Jews, even Russians. were protesting against the Yanukovych government. So, I mean, this there's a complexity here. I think we're not grabbing a hold of as well.
Yeah, and I think it is a very complex situation, and that's why I say the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend, and I think that stands for people who are looking at these fascist parties. It also, on the left, we really can't see Yanukovych or Putin as allies, because Yanukovych himself was hardly an anti-imperialist. He sent troops to Iraq and Afghanistan. He was just as willing to collaborate with the West as he was with Russia for his own power, and a very corrupt guy as well. So I wouldn't play him up as heroes, and there's a very legitimate reasons for people to have been in these protests. But it's a little bit like even during the Occupy movement, there was this small, much smaller, far-right element that kind of moved in with right-wing conspiracy theories and tried to, ideologically influence the way some of the Occupy encampments were going. This, what happened in Ukraine, was that kind of thing, only very, very successful, and ending up, participating in the overthrow of a government. And so we have this complex situation elsewhere in the world where, there was a democratic opposition that was opposing Assad in Syria. And the West, and I think a lot of progressives, held up this movement as an example of, part of the Arab Spring. And yet you had these Islamist, Al-Qaeda-influenced kind of organizations taking advantage, being more militant than the rest of the opposition, being more aggressive, and contributing to a polarization that actually helped Assad and is helping him now, portraying all the opposition as somehow in league with the Islamists. Gaddafi did the same thing in Libya. And the West at first ignores the rise of these Islamist groups, but it eventually comes back to bite them, as it did in Benghazi. And I think it has in Syria, because there's no support for intervening against Assad, because nobody knows who's going to replace him. So we've seen this kind of situation before. These were revolutions against secular Russian-backed dictators, a little like Yanukovych, but they were very broad and included a lot of the society. But ignoring the intolerant faction of the opposition really is very short-sighted, and we're seeing that now in Ukraine, where there's now a conflict between different parts of the Ukrainian government. In fact, one of the far-right leaders from Pravi Sektor was just killed in a police raid. There are struggles between different factions of the new government. It's quite unstable. And so to somehow portray this as a people power revolution and not look at all the complexities means that we don't really have an accurate picture of what's going on.
And it's interesting to watch in the Soviet Union, excuse me, in Russia, that some of the opposition to Putin, liberal, progressive, and radical opposition to Putin and his party and his regime supported the Crimean takeover.
Well, sure. It's a big cause for a Russian nationalist. And the fact that there are fascists in the Ukrainian government just gives them more material, and vice versa. I think the Crimean annexation has been a really good thing for the Ukrainian far right, because it reinforces their view. They need each other to scare the other side. In all these societies, there's more than two sides to a conflict. I think Putin was playing to a domestic audience when he annexed Crimea, seen as unjustly taken away by Khrushchev from Russia, given to Ukraine in 1954. Again, a very complex place, because there are Crimean Tatars, the Turkic, Muslim Turkic-speaking people, who are native to Crimea, who were forcibly removed by Stalin, started to come back in the 90s, and a lot of their land and homes were taken over by both Russian and Ukrainian, ethnic Ukrainian settlers in Crimea. And so Crimea is kind of a flashpoint, always has been since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. It wasn't a big surprise to me that the overthrow of the government in Ukraine stimulated this secession of Crimea. It had long been predicted because this is an area of Ukraine, of the new state of Ukraine, that never was fully integrated and where there was always a lot of fight for autonomy that was limited by the Ukrainian government. The question now is, does this spread to places like Donetsk, Luhansk, and eastern Ukraine? And that really would be a major battle. I mean, that could be even a civil war that Russia and NATO could get involved in. I don't see that happening in the immediate future, but things can spiral out of control.
That's the frightening possibility that is there, because we just don't know how this could which way it could explode. I mean, you look at, because you look at places. I was thinking about this and what you're writing and some of the stuff that you have been involved in. That, you know, if you look at places like Sarajevo or Baghdad, that before conflicts happened, these communities that went to war with each other lived with each other. Intermarriage.
Mm-hmm.
Both in Sarajevo and in Baghdad. I mean, 70-some% of all the marriages in Baghdad were between Sunnis and Shias and Christians and Jews. And it used to be a plurality Jewish city, and people lived together. And Sarajevo is the same kind of mixture of people living together. And a woman that I know who's Moldavian said to my wife not long ago, she said, look, Ukraine and Moldavia is the same thing. We're Moldavian and Moldavian Jews, but we lived well with the other Moldavians, and Russians were our friends. We lived in the same street, and we were being torn apart by other people. And this kind of conflict, I mean, this, in that way, can really kind of spin out of control beyond what people even want.
Yeah, and I think Americans have this view of ethnic conflict around the world that somehow it's because people are different
right.
from each other, and they don't like each other because they're different. In fact, some of the worst civil wars, and this is why it's so fascinating, in places like Bosnia, in Somalia being a good example, are between people who are almost exactly alike, and you can't even tell them apart. Northern Ireland, another example. And, you know, I think that that kind of essentialist view of why these wars happen leaves out the question of power, leaves out the question of economy, and how, especially during a downturn in the economy or some kind of struggle for political power, people are pit against each other, people who are very similar, in order to divide and conquer them, in order that they not unite together against the elites of their own ethnic group. And during these kind of conflicts, Shia and Sunni, Serb, Croat, and Muslim, these minor differences are really enhanced into almost a new nation. And we hear about the ethnic cleansing, we hear about the atrocities, but we usually only hear about the side that's opposed to Western intervention. So in Yugoslavia, we heard all about ethnic cleansing by the Serbs, but in the Western media, almost never saw ethnic cleansing by the U.S.-backed Croatian or Kosovar Albanian forces.
Right.
In Afghanistan, we hear a lot about how the Taliban repressed women's rights. We never hear about how the Mujahideen warlords backed by the U.S. repressed women's rights 4 years before the Taliban came in. And so we get this oversimplified view of victims and victimizers. And if you don't know your history, you don't know that the cycle very quickly changes where the today's victim becomes tomorrow's victimizer, and then the West ends up backing that. And that's what I'm afraid is potentially happening in Ukraine by ignoring this fascist element in the new government and saying that's just a bunch of Putin propaganda, is really ignoring the fact that there's a real history of ethnic violence, of atrocity, and of people being divided from each other. There's some optimistic things happening. I think in Bosnia, in particular, in the last few months, there's been a really interesting coming together of ethnic groups against their elites, partly because of, you know, the broken promises around the economy. And you even have some Ukrainians saying, you know, they're embarrassed by the far right and they want to vote against them in the next election. You have Russians saying that they're not necessarily on board with Putin and his move into Crimea. And so there are also those voices that we never really hear about, the ones that want to downplay the differences between the ethnic groups and look at what they might have in common.
Well, I'm going to thank you so much, Dr. Zoltan Grossman, for joining us today, political culture geographer at Evergreen State, author of numerous books. And the article we found him was Ukraine, the Enemy of Your Enemy Is Not Always Your Friend. We'll be linking to his website on our website, sinoshow.org. You can see the rest of his work. Zoltan, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
We have to take a very brief break, but when we return, we'll listen to a fascinating panel I moderated last month with the Morgan University School of Architecture and Planning, exploring design as social practice. What does racial engagement really mean when it comes to design, our communities, our buildings, the way we live our lives? We're going to find out in just a minute, so stay with us.